Welcome to Prophecy Radio, the Percy Jackson podcast that will keep you up to date on all things Rick Riordan and Rick Riordan Presents, including upcoming books, adaptations, and more. This is episode number 23. My name is Karen, and I am joined by a very chilly Kristen.
Yes.
She's covered in a very adorable elephant blanket.
We are currently in, I don't know, what is it, winter's resurgence? Is that
fool
the...
Fool spring?
Well, fool spring was last week.
Yeah.
We've worked back into another phase of winter, but hopefully it's the last one. God.
Yeah.
It was 17 degrees last night. Gross. 17. I got in my car, and I was like, this is colder than the entire month of January. Like, come on. So, yeah, no. But hopefully it will go away. I'm just really cold right now.
That 70-degree day we had the one time, that was pretty nice.
It's supposed to be 60 on Wednesday, so hopefully we're saying goodbye.
Yeah.
That's just us here in the Midwest, you know.
Might have to plan something for Wednesday, then.
Yeah, do something fun.
If you would like to contact us, you can do so at Prophecy Podcast on Twitter, at Prophecy Radio Podcast on Tumblr, Instagram, and Facebook, and at Prophecy Radio Podcast at gmail.com. Today, we're going to do our What If Season 2 ideas all about Sea of Monsters, but before we do that, we're going to get into some news and updates. And first on the list is, once again, talking about Mark Ashiro, because they are everywhere and everything's coming up Mark, which, you know, I'm not complaining about. Okay, so I wasn't aware of this, so in case anybody else isn't, the Rainbow Book List is an annual annotated bibliography consisting of quality LGBTQIA+ literature intended for readers 0 through 18. This is kind of something that libraries and teachers and parents can look at and find books that will be age appropriate for their kids that talk about LGBTQIA stuff or have, you know, queer characters, that sort of thing. Sounds amazing. I will put a direct link to the Google Drive with the list of books because their website is still under construction. So there's just a Google Drive right now. I hadn't heard about this before, but I mean, that's an incredible resource.
Heck,
and really cool. So Mark has two top 10 designations with Each of Us a Desert and The Insiders. And I mean, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Like, you know,
yeah.
To be recognized like that, especially with queer stories and to have this whole list put together. I think that's really cool.
Yeah, no, I agree. I absolutely agree.
Next up, on the Reed Riordan website, we got a little bit of an article about Pegasi. The actual title is How to Care for Your Pegasus with Reyna and Scipio. This article was really kind of funny. So it's like the Reed Riordan website is interviewing Reyna about, you know, what a Pegasus is, where Pegasus comes from, all that kind of stuff. And she's talking about it and going through it. And there are some really funny lines like Scipio's heritage is that he comes from Pegasus. You know, Pegasus, the actual Pegasus created all the other Pegasi. I think we've talked about that before. She goes, it's annoying because whenever Pegasus gets injured, all his offspring experience the pain. Skippy would whine for days after his dad stubbed his hoof or stepped on a Lego or something. That's just like, that's so funny and so ridiculous.
Oh,
but
yeah.
And then she's talking about all this other stuff and then casually drops that Scipio was poisoned and that he died and that the Pegasus standing with her now is Guido. And it got really dark near the end. And even like it says rr.com and they were confused and like, oh, maybe this is not the best person to be talking to about how to keep Pegasus safe and how to care for your Pegasus and stuff like that. So it was an interesting article. I'll link to that as well. Aww. Next up, the Arusha and the End of Time graphic novel will be coming out soon, and on the Reed Riordan website, they wrote, "It's time to get ready for the upcoming release of Arusha and the End of Time, the graphic novel. Roshni Chokshi reaches out to writer Joe Caramagna and illustrator Anu Chuhan to talk about their experiences working on the adaptation, and we have the transcript." So it's just an interview of the three of them kind of talking about the creation of this. And I thought that was really cool. And with Arusha and the Nectar of Immortality coming out in early April, everything's coming up Arusha right now. Just like everything's coming up Mark.
Mm-hmm.
Pretty cool. And in case you didn't know, Vikto Nye shared the solution for the labyrinth puzzle on the book 4 cover. I thought that was pretty cool. It was very tiny.
Yeah.
The lines were very tiny, and I was like, I thought about trying to figure it out myself at one point, and I was like, I don't got time for that.
It's too tiny.
Yeah.
Too tiny.
And lastly, you can read an excerpt from Ballad and Dagger out May 3rd on the Reed Riordan website. Unfortunately, this is the same first chapter that went up on Nerdist in November, so it's not new. But the book is coming out in, like, less than 2 months, so it'll be here sooner than you think.
And if you missed it on Nerdist, you can read it now on Reed Riordan, so, you know, it'll be new to you.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, so kind of quick-fire news and updates this week, you know. It's always shorter when we don't have to go through the blog.
I was going
to
say, we were minus a Rick blog post telling us all the things we want to know about Hollywood. So, yeah, it goes a little faster when we're not breaking down all the goodies.
I didn't put this in here, but Becky once again tweeted about, like, when we know who the trio is, we'll let you know. So that's just a good reminder. I'm sure they get those messages all the time.
Oh, yeah.
They're so patient with everybody.
Yeah.
My goodness. But yeah. Okay, so like I said before, we are going to do our What If Season 2 ideas. Now, in case you guys didn't see the episode before, didn't listen to it. We are an audio podcast. Episode 9 is when we did our first What If ideas, and this is based off of the Marvel show where they basically take an aspect of a story we're already familiar with, change one detail, and kind of follow the path to see how it would change everything in the future. Sometimes even the smallest changes have the biggest impacts. And when we got done with that, we had so much fun doing it that we're like, we have to do this again. And we kind of decided we're going to try to do it after each book. So this time it's all going to be about stuff that happens in Sea of Monsters, changing one aspect of it and seeing what happens and how it would change the rest of the books.
This was an exercise in me trying to remember details, and apparently my brain is just not made for keeping track of details.
Yeah. I had some trouble with that too, and I was trying to think of the big events that happened and kind of going through my head like, okay, they're on the ship, and then they fight the monsters, and then they're on the island, and I was like, but there are, you know, we just talked about that for like 2 months.
Right. It should not be that hard.
No, and now I'm just like, Titan's Curse. Like, that's everything that I have in my head at the moment.
I told Karen, my first one, like, I started writing one, and it was definitely from the chapters of Titan's Curse that we're going to be talking about today. And I was like, wait, no, I can't do that.
Yeah.
This just has to be about Sea of Monsters. Like, what are you doing?
Not allowed.
Nope, we have to save those for when we
Did you write it down so that you would remember?
I think I'll remember.
Oh, okay.
It was pretty obvious.
I already don't remember the one that I had thought of. As I was reading the books, the chapters this morning, I was like, oh, this would be really good. Oh, no, can't do that. It's about Titan's Curse. Have no idea what I was thinking of, so.
Aw, it'll come to you.
Oops. Yeah. Maybe. If not, I'll make something else up.
Exactly.
Okay, so my first idea actually starts off Sea of Monsters, and this is one of the ideas that I think could potentially have the biggest impact, and I'm not 100% sure how it would work, how the rest of the story would work without this, so this will be a good, like, I'm going to throw it out there and see what you think. So what if Grover had never been able to create the empathy link? So that's kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
So, like, one, would they even know he was missing? Because he was out on his
quest.
Search.
Search,
yeah.
He was searching.
He was searching, like a good Hufflepuff. no, that's finding. That was a bad joke.
Well, in order to find stuff, you have to search.
That's true. It's okay. All right, thank you.
I think Grover could be a Hufflepuff.
I think, yeah.
Yeah.
He's definitely a Hufflepuff.
Yeah, I feel the Hufflepuff. Yeah, so it's okay. Don't panic.
All right. Sorry. I have a little anxiety there for a minute. Okay. Mm-hmm. Anyway, back on track. So so would they even know that he was missing? Because he was out searching for Pan, and without this empathy link, Percy would have had no idea that anything was wrong. So I'm thinking, like, maybe somebody else could have warned them. Like, would one of the gods have done it? They try not to get involved. Maybe, like, a tree spirit or a water spirit. Like, they could have...
Yeah. Well, the only other thing I was thinking is it wouldn't... Grover being missing, the only thing that that does is propel Percy toward the quest, like needing to be on the quest to save Grover. Everything else, I feel like, still would have taken place exactly as planned. So they may have been able to save him. They just wouldn't have known he was there. Because, like, they still would have gotten the quest. Like, Clarice still would have gone to the island.
But did they even know about the Golden Fleece without
that whole situation?
I mean,
that's a pretty well-known thing, though,
isn't it? The Golden Fleece is, but I think the whole idea...
Knowing where it was?
Yeah, because my other questions were, would they have known about the Golden Fleece? How else could they have come across that information? And how would they have known that Polyphemus was the one holding him hostage?
Well, right, that's what I mean. Like, they wouldn't have known that Polyphemus was holding him hostage. But if the tree was poisoned... And they were brainstorming ways to fix it, and they thought Golden Fleece. There's got to be a Greek way of locating a missing object or something. You know what I mean? Like, there's got to be, like, not necessarily a spell, but, like,
yeah,
a god that can help them find... I'm trying to think if there is specifically one of them that can, like, help them locate the thing they need or whatever. I mean... Granted, Percy probably would have used that in the first book, but gods are pesky. But, you know, like, I feel like there would have probably been... So they could have come to the conclusion that they needed the Golden Fleece, that it was the best way to fix the situation, and could have gotten there without knowing Grover was there. Grover just kind of propelled Percy to push for it, which eventually meant that Clarice got the quest and they went. So, like, I mean, that would be the big determining factor is, I guess, would Mr. D/Tantalus have sent Clarice on the quest to begin with?
Yeah.
It's interesting.
I think it would have been interesting, too, to kind of keep most of the same narrative. What if Tyson had showed up and was basically like, your friend Grover's in trouble. You know, I saw him, like, because Polyphemus is also a Cyclops, like, maybe he heard something and then came to Percy and was like, you have to go rescue your friend. And it feeds into Annabeth still not trusting Tyson, but then Percy would still be like, we have to do this, we have to listen to him. And I think it would have painted Tyson a little bit more menacing in the beginning, like, you really wouldn't have trusted him in the beginning, whereas I feel like the second he's on the page, you're like, he seems good.
Yeah.
He seems really gentle and nice and innocent and naive. And even though Annabeth doesn't trust him, like, I wasn't really ever on her side.
Yeah. It would have been more of a reveal later when Tyson, like, saves Percy. Tyson kind of goes out of his way to help Percy later on, and I feel like that would have made those reveals a little stronger, because, like, if you don't know Tyson's main motivation the whole time, like, we know that Tyson's a good guy.
Yeah.
And we kind of, you know, it's kind of easy to read that he really just loves Percy and wants to help his brother and be there. And, you know, if his motivations were a little more murky, I think the end of that book would have maybe been a little more intense.
Right. Like, the confirmation that he's going to help Polyphemus, that he's helping Percy. You're right. It probably would have made a little bit of a bigger impact. That being said, I love the empathy link, and I'm glad that it exists.
So useful.
I think it really, without it, you know, you'd really have to come up with a completely different way of getting this quest off the ground.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, so what was your first big what if idea?
Okay, so mine is, what if the Sea of Monsters was actually in Poseidon's domain?
Okay.
So when they first, like, figure out that they're going to the Sea of Monsters, someone says, like, yeah, it's outside Poseidon's domain, so, like, he can't help us, and sorry, Percy, but your powers are going to be limited there, too. So it kind of, I mean, when I first think of Sea of Monsters and how much time they spend on boats and on the water, I always assume that it's going to be very Percy heavy because that's like his deal, like that's, yeah, you know, his sweet spot. And so it seems so counterproductive that there's a large random portion of the ocean where Poseidon's just like powerless. Yeah. And it kind of sucks because Percy has this opportunity to be really useful and helpful, and now he can't do anything.
Yeah.
So
I wonder what that's like too. Like, can you put 1 foot in one area and 1 foot in the rest and be on, like, state lines, like, in two different states, you know? Like, here's Poseidon's domain on one side and I'm half there, and here's the other half in the Sea of Monsters. You know, does he have, like, caution tape strung around the area? Like, don't pass this border.
Or does his power just, like, stop the minute it hits that line, like, the invisible line?
And also, like, if that's not Poseidon's domain, like, he's still Poseidon, so he'd still be powerful, but, like, does that take away any of Poseidon's power? That's interesting. It's, yeah, like, can you throw Poseidon into the middle of the Sea of Monsters and
he'd drown?
Right? That would be not funny. That'd
it
be
would
horrible,
be insane, but, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, my first question that kind of popped in my head when I thought about this was, would it make this an easy-peasy quest? Because they do encounter a lot of challenges on the water and getting to the island.
Mm-hmm.
If Percy was able to use his abilities and Poseidon was able to kind of be there to help like he has been in the past, I feel like they could have easily bypassed a lot and just gotten to the island. So it makes sense why at least Rick made the choice to make the Sea of Monsters not part of Poseidon's domain. I get it. I totally get why he made that decision. But it would have simplified the quest quite a bit.
Yeah.
For sure.
Definitely.
They still would have had to deal with all the Polyphemus of it all.
Uh-huh.
Like, it wouldn't have made getting the fleece that much easier. It just would have made getting to the fleece that
right.
much easier. The second question is, would that give Poseidon control over Scylla and Charybdis?
Interesting.
Because,
wait, Poseidon or Percy?
Well, I was thinking Poseidon.
Okay.
Because, like, as of now, they reign supreme.
Right.
And they can eat and destroy whomever they feel like. And if that was part of his domain, would he be able to use them for his own means? So, like,
right.
he's pushing ships he doesn't want to make it to land or whatever into the Sea of Monsters and then has these two go at it. And, like, he can say, these ships will pass unscathed. Like,
right.
you can't mess with them. So,
yeah.
it would be interesting.
I feel like they would probably listen to him. Like, maybe he can't actually control them, but it would be in their favor to listen to him so that, you know, he keeps feeding them ships and stuff.
Yeah, definitely true. This next one is kind of obvious. I kind of already answered it. Could Percy have sped them straight to Polyphemus and passed any and all perilous side quests?
Probably yes.
Yeah. It also would have lost you Annabeth listening to the sirens, which was important to her.
Major part.
And
yeah.
Percy getting a glimpse at what she's capable of. And, like, you know, because he got to kind of see a bit of what Annabeth was seeing and what mm-hmm. she was learning about herself. So I feel like that is something that Percy uses to kind of get closer to Annabeth. Like, he knows more about her from what he saw there.
Mm-hmm.
And so I feel like you would lose some, plus him turning into a guinea pig.
Yeah.
You know, it's a bonding moment that she saved him and,
mm-hmm.
you know, all of that. So you would miss some really funny, interesting moments,
yeah.
not to mention Tyson, like, exploding and
mm-hmm.
surviving and showing up to save the day. Like, you wouldn't have any of that. He'd
yeah.
just be along for
the
ride.
I think the book would be, like, a quarter of the length. Like,
for sure.
There wouldn't be nearly as much. You couldn't really call it Sea of Monsters. That wouldn't be scary.
Right.
It'd just be, like, an area of the ocean that they would go through.
Right. Rick is so smart.
Yeah.
The last question that kind of came to my head was, would Percy have deserved more credit for the quest going well? So would, instead of even if it was Clarice's quest when they left, if he's the only reason they got there, he might not necessarily, like, push for credit. Because by the end of this, Percy kind of knows that Clarice needs it more than him. But would it have felt like Clarice deserved the credit if Percy just single-handedly got them there and then basically single-handedly saved them getting to the ship, you know? And
part of me is like, no, because it would just basically be Poseidon going, I don't want my kid to die, and not letting anything bad happen to Percy.
Yeah, it's just
But maybe if there were other obstacles in the way and he got to use his water powers more, like, you know, it could be that he was a little bit more vital to the actual quest than than what he was in the book.
Yeah, it was one of those things. But yeah, so not a, like a super huge thing. It would have simplified matters a lot, put it that way.
And which is not always entertaining.
But you're right, like, kind of thinking about the Sea of Monsters as, like, a Poseidon dead zone, like, it's almost more interesting to kind of bandy about the idea of, like, does that mean, like, if it's not, it would be Poseidon's domain. If it was going to be anybody's domain, it'd be Poseidon's. So does that mean it's nobody's domain?
Yeah, no man's land.
Yeah, so is, like, that no the only ocean? Area of the planet that isn't really under a god's thumb?
I find this really interesting because, as we know, the gods are not invulnerable. Like, they have weaknesses. The Olympians defeated the Titans, and, you know, Cronus was a super powerful being, and Zeus took him down, and so did the others. So, like, they can be trapped. They, not necessarily killed, but they can be, like, broken apart and, you know, held captive. And all of them have weaknesses, and they're always kind of, there's always infighting there. I do find it really interesting thinking about, okay, you know, maybe this is a little dark, but, like, how would you kill Poseidon? Or how would you trap him so that he was no longer relevant? And then what would happen if that were to be the case? Yeah. Would somebody take over his position? Or would the oceans be wreaking havoc on the entire planet?
Mm-hmm.
That's a much bigger what-if question, right, I think.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Not necessarily a straight out of Sea of Monsters, but it's Sea of Monsters adjacent, so it's definitely, it's worth thinking about.
Yeah. Now, my next one actually isn't all that different than yours. I think we kind of are working in a similar direction. So mine was, what if Clarice and Percy didn't hate each other? And I actually, this is my favorite one that I thought of, because I do like Clarice, as annoying as she can be sometimes. And I think the idea of them being friends is really interesting. So say she still won the chariot races and she still got the quest. Okay, so everything else is the same. But she worked with Percy to, like, meet him somewhere. So she's kind of in on him hijacking the quest. How would she be able to do all of this with Ares still hating Percy? And does that mean Ares wouldn't have given her the ship? Because that's a pretty big, significant thing that had to happen. She needed to get that ship. And would she pretend to hate Percy just to get basically intel from Ares and from that side of things? I think her playing both sides is very interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Kind of lends itself more to, like, Annabeth's battle strategy aspect of it.
Yeah.
Clarice isn't quite there yet, obviously, but I love the idea of her and Percy kind of, you know, locking themselves away, hiding in a corner and whispering to each other and trying to play up this idea that they hate each other, but really working with each other behind closed doors.
Yeah, no, it would definitely change the overall mood. I mean, I think Clarice's competitiveness, especially with Percy, is what drives her to do some really dumb things.
Yes.
And so if they're not in competition, if they're working together, then chances are they wouldn't have had some of the extra complications that they didn't need to have.
That was my next point, is, like, she would have listened to... No, it was a good segue. She would have listened to Percy and Annabeth when they went up against Scylla and, you know, would probably still have her ship, would still have all the zombie Confederate guys on her ship if she wasn't too proud to actually listen to somebody else.
Yeah.
I think the more interesting aspect for me is how much this would anger Aries and how this would affect her relationship, which is already a crappy relationship.
Mm-hmm.
You know, her dad is awful to her. And maybe that's one of the reasons why she likes Percy or something is like right. She wants to make her dad angry and she doesn't like the way that he treats her. So she's going to team up with the kid that he hates, you know?
Well, I mean, if she was maybe slightly more, I'm going to say self-aware, but that's not really the word I'm looking for. Like if she realized how Aries is treating her and wasn't so eager to please him and mm-hmm. to make him proud, if she said, fine, like, you know, I don't need your approval. You're never going to give it to me anyway. You'd rather have your sons. Right. You know, you'd rather give your approval to your sons. You're never going to give it to me. If she kind of saw that and said, I'm going to do what I want and befriend Percy in that respect, I would be really interested in how Aries inserts himself into the quest to make it more difficult.
Right.
Because
that's true, yeah.
He would definitely have gotten involved, whether it's one of the monsters, like, becoming super-powered or something, or, you know, another ship shows up and it puts them through an actual, like, ship naval battle.
Maybe a son of Ares shows up to battle them
right.
or something.
Like,
yeah.
I could definitely see him throwing some shots at both of them, but specifically Clarice.
Yeah.
If she went against him.
I think that would be really interesting, actually, and not only her having already decided to be with Percy, but also, like, struggling with the fact that, okay, now my own father's coming after me, now my fellow campers are coming after me, did I make the right choice, is this worth it, and her sticking by it and coming out successful in the end, and basically proving everyone wrong, would have been a really cool, like, redemption arc for Clarice. I think I would have liked that a lot.
Yeah, would have been a very different Clarice.
Yeah, oh, definitely. And I was wondering, like, could she have sailed them back to camp? Like, if they hadn't lost the ship, then they could have sailed back to camp. Her and Percy could have come in together and maybe showed everybody, hey, we're working together. You know, the gods aren't always right. We don't always have to listen to them. Would have had a very different moral of the story by the end of the book. But,
yeah,
you know,
for sure.
I like this idea a lot. Not gonna lie. This kind of came out pretty interesting.
Yeah, no. I definitely would be interested in reading that. And I'm sure, you know, if someone's written the fanfic.
Right, exactly.
If anyone comes across one.
I bet there's some Clarice and Percy fanfic out there.
There's
like
gotta
100%.
Be. And I would really love it if there was like a platonic, I mean, I'm sure there's, you know, romantic
yeah.
ones. But I would love if there was just, yeah, more platonic relation between them. Like mm-hmm. them just hanging out and talking about, you know, battle. Because let's face it, like Percy loves a battle too. You know,
yeah.
he likes getting in there with Riptide and getting dirty and all that. So, like, it would be cool to see him and Clarice as friends and him maybe, you know, through her getting to know the other sons and daughters of Aries and all of that. Like, mm-hmm. it would just be really cool.
And you could still keep a lot of Clarice's edge and the banter that they have and everything. Like, you could still have a kind of combative friendship where they pick on each other a lot. You don't really have to change Clarice's personality to be able to do something like this, so.
Clarice would definitely still think she was the superior
fighter.
Oh,
yeah, 100%.
And she would definitely pick on Percy in any every chariot race,
like
wall climb,
big sister, little brother.
Absolutely.
I would really love that kind of
yeah.
relationship.
Oh yeah.
Yeah.
No, that would definitely be a really fun side quest, side trip to take.
Yeah.
Is down their friendship path. That would be cool.
Yeah. All right. So what's your last main what if scenario?
Okay. So what if we learned in Sea of Monsters that Tyson reached out to Poseidon and asked for a friend, asked for help, because his life in the human world was really miserable. And Poseidon, you know, presents him with Percy, who he doesn't know is his brother, but quickly learns is his brother, and it changes Tyson's life. But if Tyson never prayed to Poseidon for help, if he never asked for a friend, how would that change not just Sea of Monsters, but largely, like, Percy?
Right.
I think he grows a lot in this book.
Yeah, I agree.
Through, especially, like, compassionately through Tyson and seeing his own behavior when Tyson first shows up at camp. And, like, outside of camp, he was a friend that he took care of at school, and he was totally cool with it. Then when he finds out that Tyson is his half-brother and he's basically yoked to Tyson all the time, Percy kind of gets really annoyed really fast, and he doesn't treat him the best. And then Percy later on, like, realizing that, you know, how much he cares for Tyson and how much he needs him and really does value that relationship, like, it's a whole road that Percy goes on in this book. And if Tyson isn't around for any of it because Poseidon never shows him how to find Percy, we would lose a lot of really good character growth for Percy.
Yeah, I think I 100% agree with you. I think that character work would probably come eventually, but it wouldn't have been in such an isolated, like, compact scenario. And him choosing to spare Polyphemus, him just understanding that not all monsters are actually monsters. I mean, that's a huge lesson to learn this early on. And I believe that Percy is a good person and he wants to do right by people. But if you don't have that experience, you kind of don't know better. And now he knows better, and it has opened up his eyes a whole bunch. So that's really interesting, because you said it completely changed Tyson's life, but it also really changed Percy's. Now, the interesting thing here is, where would Tyson be? So yeah. Tyson would still be living on the streets, right? Like, that's where he was. And maybe he would fall into the wrong crowd of Cyclops and, you know, not really understand that demigods can be good. Maybe he'd be afraid of them or something. And what if these two came upon each other much later in the story? They would have cemented themselves as people a little bit more than they have now and might not have gotten along. Although Tyson is so sweet, I can't really imagine him not believing that demigods are good and, you know, not wanting to be nice to people. But
The next question, I basically said, could Percy have died before his time? Like, could he have died in this book or before, you know, we all know Percy and where Percy is currently at the end of two series or three series.
Yeah.
But, like, you know, sometime along the timeline of this book or even, like, the next couple of books, would Tyson's lack of presence, like, there's a lot that Tyson gives to Percy throughout these stories, the shield, other things that do keep Percy safe. And it's not just that, like, if Tyson wasn't around at school to help kind of keep the monsters away, like, could Percy have potentially not made it through this year of school and never made it to camp for Sea of Monsters? Like, I just wonder if, you know, how big of an impact did Tyson being around really have on Percy's life that he doesn't even realize?
Yeah.
Is more or less the question I'm asking.
I feel like there were a lot of moments where Tyson stepped in. Like, we know he's fireproof, and he helped save camp from the bulls.
The bull, yep.
And the whole thing with the ship. And then, yeah, building Percy that shield and just being there with him as not even a Cyclops, just another person to be by his side in battle. There's definitely a moment where, you know, if he hadn't been there, Percy could have died.
Yeah. So it's more than just, like, how they affect each other as far as, like, character growth and that, too. Like, I really do think Tyson's presence could change a lot of what Percy is around for. Like, he really did give a lot of support and protection to Percy that he may not have even been aware, realized was going on.
Yeah.
And then lastly, if Tyson wasn't really around for Sea of Monsters, we would lose a lot of growth for Annabeth as well.
Oh, yeah. Definitely.
Yeah, because, like, Percy obviously is the biggest impact that a loss of Tyson would have. But she really goes on a bit of a journey in this, not just coming to find out that, you know, not all Cyclops are evil, because that's the obvious one. But I think she learned a lot about how she sees things and, like, how she is also possible, you know, it's possible that she has prejudices and, just because something happened between her mom and another god doesn't mean that that has to be how the world goes on and on and on forever. Like, not all Cyclopses are evil. She has to, you know, take each one as you would a person. You know, you have to treat, I mean, not, maybe not every monster you meet, but, you know, you have to treat characters and people who come into your life, you have to give them some space to prove that they're not out to get you.
Right. And in fact, I think that this would have pushed her in the opposite direction, because then you would only have Polyphemus. You would only have the Cyclops trying to eat Grover, and it would further cement what she already thought about them. So really, yeah, I mean, Tyson's presence impacted Annabeth a lot too. And without him, you would definitely lose all that. And it would be interesting to see if that would have potentially made her a darker character down the line.
I mean, I really do think that this, confronting this aspect of her own personality, being honest with herself about, okay, maybe I was wrong, it's humbling. And Annabeth has never come across as a particularly, like, arrogant character. Like, she can be a little bit when she knows what's going on.
She can also back that up, though.
Well, yeah, that's true. Absolutely. Like, but she does, she has a humbleness to her, too. Mm. Like, she's not constantly bragging, you know, about her own abilities and whatever. She wants to give people a chance to shine, and she wants to, you know, it's not all for her all the time. She, after she got her quest in Lightning Thief and, like, got out of camp and had a chance to stretch her legs and be a real demigod, I feel like that mellowed her a lot.
Mm.
So, because prior to that, she was so anxious to do anything that I feel like she was constantly trying to prove to people that she was capable, so she wouldn't take on that humble, you know. But now she's a lot more aware that, like, everyone has something that they're bringing to the table, and, like, yeah. So, definitely would have been a rough one for Annabeth. Would have changed her a bit, that's for sure.
So, just like last time, we also have two bonus ideas that we didn't flesh out quite as much. Although, to be honest, mine is fleshed out kind of the same amount.
Mine pretty much is too.
So maybe these are just, you know, two more that
it's
you guys
three,
can enjoy.
Maybe.
Yeah. But my other one was, what if Luke had convinced Annabeth to join his side? And this is kind of related to the idea that we did last time, where what if Kronos had gotten to Percy first, and how would that have changed everything? So maybe Annabeth really believed that Talia would have been on Luke's side, or she still had a big enough crush on him, still trusted him enough that it convinced her to try to be on his side. I feel like a lot more campers would have left to join Luke's side if Annabeth had been with him. Because even though she's young, I feel like she's been around long enough that a lot of people respect her mind and her ability to kind of see both sides of the equation and, you know, to lay out these battle plans, that if she's like, all right, I'm going with Luke, it would at least make some people pause and go, oh, maybe we should too.
I agree. I absolutely agree. Annabeth is, especially in the absence of Luke, a pretty big presence at Camp Half-Blood. Mm-hmm. Like, she's a leader. She's been there longer than just about anybody at this point, especially with Luke gone. And I think, yeah, you would definitely see a lot more campers questioning whether they're on the right side or not. Annabeth leaving Camp Half-Blood and joining Luke and going in this crusade against the gods, that could have turned the tide.
Yeah.
It really could have.
And speaking realistically, I don't think that she would have gone as far as Luke, but I think that she can still see some merit in the idea that the gods are not the parents that they should be. Like, she even has issues with Athena, even though I think Athena has treated her relatively well, especially compared to, like, some of the other kids.
Yeah.
But I feel like she would have been like, okay, Luke has a point, and maybe she would have softened him a little bit if she had switched sides. But I also feel like, my other question was, how far would Annabeth have let things go? Because I feel like she would have switched back over eventually. Eventually, Luke would have been too much, and the idea of Kronos coming back and seeing what's really going on there would have been too much for her, and she would have admitted her mistakes and come back to the Camp Half-Blood side.
I wonder if Luke would have been able to actually tell her the whole plan. I don't know if Annabeth ever joins his side if she knows that he's going to raise Kronos.
Right, like I think that he would had to have lied to her or kept things secret.
So if she didn't know that his ultimate plan was to raise Kronos, if she thought he had something else that he was, you know, working on and just didn't tell her.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's...
Because, and I could see her kind of wanting to blindly trust him because they've been through so much together.
Mm-hmm.
So that wouldn't be completely unrealistic to me.
And it's easier to kind of be blind to that sort of thing when you have an attachment to a person like that. Like, not only have they been through thick and thin, but she has feelings. Like, she does have a little crush. So it would be easier to just not see everything he's getting into and where he's steering the ship to. And
That's one of the reasons why I was a little hesitant to say, like, oh, maybe she has a big enough crush on him, because Annabeth knows her own mind. She is her own person. I don't think she would necessarily let a boy make her do something stupid, but loving somebody like that does blind you a little bit, and I think that she would have given him the benefit of the doubt where he didn't deserve it.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, that's a really good point. And, you know, I was wondering, how would this have affected Percy and Annabeth's friendship and their eventual relationship? Because when they first meet, they're a little, you know, there's a little bit of antagonism between them. Not a whole lot, but they don't really know each other that well. And then it builds and builds and builds as they go through more experiences. This wouldn't have just set them back to where they had started. It would have sent them back even further. And then you'd have to build that trust again. I like the idea of that. I like the idea of Annabeth having to prove herself again to Percy and for him to eventually trust her, and then getting to the place where they are now. It would have been a very interesting road. I don't think I would have liked that idea as much, because I like, you know, Annabeth the way she is, obviously. But yeah, it could have caused for a very interesting break in that friendship that they have.
I do love a good anti-hero. Right. And if you took Annabeth and basically made her Luke, I mean, Luke still exists and he kind of lures her over to that side, but I can see her kind of, like, if she truly believes in his cause, in getting to the gods and teaching them a lesson and all of that, I can kind of see her and Percy having a bit of an antagonistic, like, back and forth for a little while. And then eventually them finding some common ground when she really realizes what Luke is up to. And she says, like, I never thought he'd go this far. Like, I agreed with what he was saying, and he had some good points, but this is way too far. Like, I can see her crossing back over, and then, yeah, you'd have to watch them build that trust.
Right.
Back up. That would be, yeah.
I mean, who doesn't love an enemies to lovers story, so.
The best.
Yeah. Okay, what's your last one?
Okay, so in Sea of Monsters, Annabeth gets herself pretty gravely injured on the island, and they wrap her in the Golden Fleece and heal her. What if, and this is a big what if because the Golden Fleece is pretty freaking powerful, what if using the Golden Fleece to heal Annabeth drained it too much to save Talia? So its power isn't limitless. It can't just be used to heal something and then immediately used to heal something else. It needs some downtime to, like, recharge, say. And Annabeth has used it. They had to, or she would have died. And they didn't know that this was, like, a thing. So they get back to camp and they lay it on Talia's tree and nothing happens. And then eventually her tree dies because she was right on the cusp of death at that point.
Right. Okay. So Talia's tree dies is basically the scenario here.
Yeah. But because they chose to save Annabeth.
Right.
It's kind of another part.
Right. Yeah. I like that. I mean, that's awful and terrible and really sad, but the idea of having to choose one or the other is very difficult. I, you know, it would make camp weaker, and then a weaker camp means Luke and Kronos can sweep right in. That would have caused all sorts of problems.
Yeah, that was one of my things. No border protection for the camp. We kind of talked about this with the movie.
I think there would be border protection, just not as much.
Right, because we kind of talked about how in the movie they set it up as, like, there wasn't anything, and then there was Talia, and now we have a border, and it's great. But in the books, like, there was some sort of border, but Talia really you know, charged it up and really, you know, her presence, her tree, became a really strong part of their defenses. So it wouldn't, I wouldn't necessarily say there'd be none, but it would be significantly weaker, and they would have to, I'm assuming, would be on the hunt for something to super, you know, supercharge their border again.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, would campers take turns being trees? You'd have to talk to Zeus. You'd have to talk to Zeus and see what he was willing to do.
See you in 3 months, buddy.
Everybody takes a 3-month stint as a tree.
Oh my gosh. Do you get to pick your tree? Because that would be interesting. What tree would you be? I've always loved redwoods.
See, I love a good dogwood, like a flowering dogwood. They're so pretty, and they're very, like, reading.
Could I be a fruit tree? No, because then people would eat my fruit. That'd be weird.
That would be a little weird.
That would be kind of weird.
Is there a tree that grows lots of mushrooms?
Oh, I mean, oak trees tend to have a lot of mushrooms on them.
Because I feel like you would enjoy being a tree that could house mushrooms. Had
mushrooms on them. Oh, that's such a good idea. I didn't even think about that.
That's the first thing my brain goes to when I think Karen is going to be a tree.
Could I choose to be mushrooms instead? Because mushrooms have their mycelium under the ground and they're all interconnected. So I feel like if my little, like, mushroom legs surrounded the entire camp, like, that would be a border in and of itself. I could be a fairy ring of mushrooms.
Instead of a tree. Karen would be a mushroom fairy ring. Start protecting Camp Half-Blood.
Why can't this be real?
If any of you are fan artists out there and want to attempt to draw a fairy ring of a fairy ring of mushrooms for Karen.
Fairy ring of monsters would be kind of interesting, too. Like little monster mushroom people things. That would be cute. Now we're getting crazy.
We're going nuts. Yeah. Okay. Along with this, thinking about it, like, Percy's future would definitely be far more railroaded. Like, he would have to try and figure out how to protect camp. That would be his driving force. It would make
him stay there, basically, yeah.
So he would have far less opportunities to do all the things he does in Titan's Curse and the Battle of the Labyrinth and then Last Olympian. Like, he would have other things to worry about.
Right, yeah.
Not to mention they wouldn't have gotten Talia back. How would that have affected Annabeth if she...
A lot.
If they kept her alive and that cost her Talia...
She would have been devastated.
Yeah. Like, I can only imagine the dark path that Annabeth could go on because of the depression ensuing from costing her friend her life and all of that. It definitely would have made this, like, not YA.
Yeah.
Or a very, very dark YA, if that's for sure. Certainly older than middle grade, because that would be a very mature and interesting, like, story to take this book down. And lastly, would Luke take advantage of the weakness to steal more campers to his side?
Yeah.
Just from sheer time he could spend in camp without people knowing. Mm-hmm. Like, just being able to get in and out as easily as, you know, he could this time.
Right.
I'm curious if he would take advantage of that and lure more younger campers or other people who if he had a little more time, could have, you know, drawn them to his side.
And especially with everybody being more afraid because maybe there are more monsters attacking all the time. Maybe they're like, look, this isn't worth it. Like, I'm going over to Luke's side. Like, at least I'll be alive. You know, I could see at least some of them saying that.
Yeah, like, I don't actually, like, believe in his side, but I don't think I'm going to survive here, so I'm going to go there.
Yeah.
Although then... He'd probably just feed the young ones to the monsters.
Aww.
Luke is not good.
Yeah.
Anyway, but yeah, that pretty much wraps. I mean, it's a lot to think about when you think about the tree not surviving and Talia dying. Like,
Because I was thinking, it
snowballs.
Would they send, like, other immortals? Because didn't we learn that Festus used to be the one that helped protect camp, too? Like, that's how he got his start. So would they create something else? Would they have another monster come in to protect it? How would that affect, you know, the border and the campers inside the border?
Would they have had a whole quest to get to Hephaestus and ask him for help, or, you know, I'm thinking of other gods that could help too, mm-hmm. you know, like,
who is would there, have been actually willing to,
well, right, is there a way to convince Ares that protecting the camp is vital, or does he just laugh at them and run away? He would
laugh at them, definitely.
Does Poseidon just sink everything around camp and there's a water border?
There's a moat. They just make a moat around the camp
that connects to the sound on both sides, so he's like, this is mine.
Yeah.
Like, nobody can touch it, this is mine. So, I mean, there's options, but
yeah, definitely.
Some of them are a little crazy.
Okay, so I did ask our listeners if they had any ideas for this What If episode, because last time a lot of people came up with some really interesting ones and we talked about that, and hopefully we'll get more, maybe we can discuss on next week's episode in our feedback section. But for now, I want to read Henry's tweet, his series of tweets. This is at @CHB_cabin13. Very cute. Love it. And Henry says, the only what if I've got in mind right now is, what if I was able to write myself into the Riordanverse, interact with Percy Jackson and company, and have an influence and impact on their stories and lives by just having them know me? I also wonder what it would be like if I did this, because having read all of the books, I would have knowledge of things that haven't yet happened to the characters. To imagine playing that shouldn't I reveal their future to them game with myself is exhilarating. And of course, that would change the course of their stories, butterfly effect and all that. So writing myself into their story could have serious repercussions. I've also always imagined writing my own epic sequel series on Wattpad that takes place after Trials of Apollo or the Nico book, that will serve as the endgame of the Riordanverse, in which all the pantheons across will have to unite against the ultimate darkness that threatens them all. But I don't expect Rick to read it because I know he hates fan fiction. Has he said that before? I don't know if that caught me off guard because I was
I don't think I knew that.
I don't think he hates it. He probably doesn't read it for obvious reasons, but I don't think he hates it. I don't know. We'll have to look into that. Also, if I wrote myself into Percy Jackson, I don't know what cabin I'd probably be in at CHB. Universally, my personality fits all the cabins. I have strengths, weaknesses, skills, tastes, fears, and fatal flaws from all of them. Therefore, I've accepted that there isn't just one cabin I belong to. I belong to all of them. Anyway, I've digressed enough. I can't wait to hear your guys' what if thoughts. Keep doing what you do. I love this podcast. Henry. Very sweet. Henry is always very, very sweet. I have two major thoughts on this.
Mm-hmm.
One, the idea of him already knowing what's going to happen and playing the should I, shouldn't I tell them thing, fascinating to me.
Oh, yeah.
I think that's really cool. That's like the Oracle times 10, because you're not just spitting prophecies. You actually know how the story is going to play out, and you either have to guide them toward that or be careful not to guide them away from it. I've always found those kind of stories very interesting. And the other thing is, of course, you already know I love the idea of, you know, a complete team-up book where everybody comes together and they have to fight some big thing. And I think that could be a really interesting thing to do after the Trial of Apollo books.
Yeah.
So, yeah, this was some interesting ideas, and it's very fun to go down the rabbit hole and kind of see what happens there.
I mean, short of, like, inserting myself entirely into the story, like, it also, okay, what if you were given the opportunity to, like, jump into the story at one point and change one thing? Like,
right. Oh,
like,
yeah.
What one thing would you maybe consider changing, or, since we know how it ends, would we want to change anything? Because it could mess
with... Would we want to save anybody's life?
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. it's an interesting... I haven't thought about this, so my brain is don't ask me for an answer.
That is kind of a cool idea, though, is like, okay, if you had to change one thing about the entire Percy Jackson series, what is the one thing you would change? That's hard. I can't answer that right now.
No.
Maybe our listeners have good ideas.
Yeah. Yeah. If you have an answer to that, if you have something that sticks out in your brain or something that, you know, you think could make the story really, really cool or something, you know, whatever, feel free. Reach out. Let us know what you're thinking.
But until then, should we jump into Titan's Curse?
Absolutely. Nice. So we are on chapters 3 and 4. And of course, we're going to start with chapter 3. Bianca D'Angelo makes a choice. Artemis simultaneously calms and irritates Percy and Talia, telling them that Annabeth is gone, but that if she, a brave maiden, is anywhere to be found, Artemis will find her. That's a bit of a head scratcher. Anywho, Zoe Nightshade explains to Bianca that she's a half-blood and that she, a maiden, can join the hunt if she so desires. Artemis then takes Bianca aside and kind of explains the situation, while Nico and Grover go play mytho-magic in the forest. This leaves Percy and Talia alone just long enough for her to shame him into feeling responsible for Annabeth's disappearance. Maybe if Percy hadn't gone after Dr. Thorne, the Manticore, all by himself, they may have been able to stop him, saving Annabeth. After a bit, Artemis asks Percy to meet her at her tent. She asks him to relay Dr. Thorne's exact words, and he does, leaving Artemis with no choice but to go off and hunt this great evil creature on her own, but not before accepting Bianca's pledge to be a hunter of Artemis. And now, all will go to Camp Half-Blood for the time being, to stay safe. But they need a ride, so Artemis reaches out to her irresponsible twin, Apollo.
Very good. So I wanted to start off with a fun fact for anybody who doesn't know. Rick Riordan named his production company Mytho-Magic after Nico's card game, which I think is adorable.
It's really cute.
And a really good production company name for the types of stuff that he's working on. Like,
absolutely.
Genius.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. No, that's really good fun, actually. Okay, so if Percy hadn't followed Dr. Thorne out of the gym, wouldn't the Manticore have killed Bianca and Nico? Like, Talia is really pissed at Percy for not, like, looking for help first. But he does. Like, before he leaves the gym, he looks around and there's nobody in sight and he doesn't really have time. So he runs off and, yes, tries to save the day. But, like, I don't necessarily think it's fair that Talia is treating him the way she is.
Yeah, I'm kind of two minds here because I, like, Talia's driving me nuts right now. She's being really mean, and I get that she's stressed out and she doesn't like the hunters, and she is probably mad that Percy went off on his own. You're right, he did look around. I feel like he could have gone to get her or something and then followed, but there is a time restraint there, and I think that he made the right choice because he wanted to make sure that these two kids were safe. At the same time, because we're privy to his thoughts, we know that he was trying to be the hero and trying to prove that he didn't need Talia. So it was maybe a selfish reason, even if it wasn't necessarily the wrong one.
Yeah.
So it's a little hard to, you know, they both probably could have done better, basically.
Agreed, agreed.
But Talia definitely needs to be nicer.
She needs to calm down.
Yeah.
She's a little bit... Again, I think the hunters are what make it worse. Like, if they hadn't, you know, been there to save the day, if somehow they'd gotten out of that scrape without the hunters, I feel like she wouldn't be anywhere near as high strung as she is at the moment.
Yeah.
She's kind of, you know, cruising down crazy alley because of them. So, what do we think about Artemis? We meet her in person and get some time to kind of understand what she's about. And
yeah.
What do you think?
She's interesting. So she appears as a 14-year-old girl because she wants to fit in with her hunters, which I think is really nice. I think that's kind of a cool thing. She's definitely one of the nicer and more interactive gods. Like, she doesn't mind boots on the ground, getting her hands dirty kind of thing. And I think she has a noble cause in hunting down the monsters. She's also arrogant, like a lot of the other gods. And so her and the hunters are really interesting to me because it's like radical feminism. It's like, girls are so much better than boys. Boys aren't allowed here. Boys are disgusting and beneath us, which is like not the point of feminism. Like, it should be equality. Right. It should be all of that. I understand them wanting their girls club kind of thing. And I do love the hunters. I think they're really cool. But sometimes it's like, wow, this is kind of intense.
Yeah, no, I agree.
And Percy feels bad about himself because of what they're saying, which is so sad.
I know. And like, I'm kind of with you. Like, it's one thing to make a choice to, you know, devote yourself to the Hunters of Artemis, devote yourself to Artemis, and you're basically saying goodbye to your romantic futures. Like, that's fine if you're making that choice for yourself, but the whole, like, ew, boys are now gross thing, it's like, okay, come on. Like, I get that it might be more of a protectionary, like, tactic. Like, if I just say that boys are gross and am not around them ever, then I will never be tempted to break my vow and, you know, die, because that would be a thing. So I don't know. Yeah, it's I like Artemis quite a bit. I feel like she's one of the more approachable gods.
Yeah, there's a little bit more humanity to her.
Yeah, it's not quite as scary to ask something of Artemis as it is to ask any of the other gods.
Although she might turn you into a jackalope, so.
Right? Boom.
Not great.
But if you're Grover, you would happily be a jackalope.
Yeah, exactly.
As long as it was at the hands of Artemis.
Grover.
He's a goofball. When it comes to Artemis especially, it's quite goofy. Zoe Nightshade. This is basically our first interaction to her.
Yeah.
We find out that her and Talia definitely have some history.
Yeah. She's not making a good first impression, Zoe.
Mm-mm.
I don't dislike her, but she is intense.
Yeah.
Like, she is really intense. And if you're intense next to Artemis and the rest of the hunters, then you probably need to tone it down a couple of notches.
I think it's funny that within moments of meeting Bianca, she's already, like, jumping at her, like, there's another option.
Yeah.
Like, you're making a lifelong pledge to not, you know, and I feel like maybe you should pump the brakes and let this poor 13, 14-year-old girl, yeah. I don't even know how old Bianca is because I'm trying to do math and I'm bad at math. Like, she's not that old and, like, she probably could use to have some time to really think through her decision and not just, you know, go with a gut, you know, gut instinct or whatever, but yeah, Zoe doesn't seem to care.
Yeah, it felt a little manipulative to me.
Yeah.
Like, she wasn't really giving the whole story, that she was painting this picture of how wonderful it is, when, like, it's also a lot of work, and it's really scary, and they're always fighting monsters. And this was one of the things that I didn't necessarily remember about the hunters that I found really interesting. So, anyone can join. Doesn't matter if you're, you know, immortal or whatever. Literally anyone can join as long as you pledge yourself to Artemis.
And you're not a boy.
Right, right. Which that would make for an interesting story. Is immortal just getting picked up off the street and joining the hunters? What would that be like, learning that demigods are real and all of that kind of stuff? I would read the heck out of that. So, Rick, if you ever feel like putting anything out like that, would read. But also, they're immortal unless they die in battle. Which, like, if I'm going to be immortal anywhere, please let it be in battle.
Right.
Like, what's the point?
Especially since your, like, raison d'etre as a hunter of Artemis is to go fight monsters.
Yeah.
Like, you should get to be immortal in battle all the time.
Yeah. Like, and I get it. Like, they're eternal, so they stay 14 forever, whatever age they are when they join, that they won't age and die. And, like, that part is cool. Like, I get that. But
is there, like, a retirement package? After 100 years of service with Artemis, can you stop fighting? Like, you still serve Artemis. You still live up to your, like,
oath. Let me make your tea.
But, like, you get the cushy job, or you get to camp out in, you know, choose, you know, Greece.
Yeah.
You're like, hey, you know, this forest in Greece, like, I'm cool here. I'm just gonna, you know,
yeah.
If you guys come by, you know, stop by and say hi, and
I'll cook you dinner.
Right, I'll make you some tea, and
yeah,
we'll get cozy. It'll be fun. Yeah, like, because that is, it's very intense as a lifelong commitment, and you're now immortal, so it's an eternal commitment as long as you don't die in battle.
Yeah, and I think what you were saying about Bianca making this decision and her, I feel like, being kind of manipulated by Zoe especially, because at least Artemis, like, took her aside and kind of was like, all right, let's just pump the brakes a little bit. Like, she wants Bianca on her side, but it didn't feel quite as manipulative as Zoe. But Bianca accepting Artemis's invitation into the hunters, it feels irresponsible. It feels like she's running away from something.
Yeah.
And I get it, like, I mean, they don't remember their time in the Lotus Hotel, but I'm sure the fact that they're orphans, that they don't know who their parents are, that they just have this, like, trust fund thing, it's a lot. And Bianca shouldn't necessarily be responsible for Nico because she's also a child. But at the same time, like, how could you do that?
Well, that's one of the things about this chapter. I think that Artemis should have insisted that Bianca go to camp. Not as a hunter.
Before she made her decision,
right.
Yeah.
I think Artemis should have looked, you know, I know Artemis thinks that being a hunter for her is the best thing you could do. But just in fairness, I really do wish she had said, go to camp, experience it, and I still think you're going to choose me. Like, give the girl an opportunity to see that even just being at camp, she wouldn't be responsible for Nico. Like, that's what Chiron and Mr. D and Percy and everyone else are for. Like, she wouldn't have nearly as much responsibility on her shoulders anymore. He'd still be her brother, and I'm sure she would feel some responsibility for him. But I'm sure all this time, she's been the one making sure he has enough to eat, making mm-hmm. sure he can afford his little figurines for Mythomagic, like, trying to make his life as normal as possible while they are dodging monsters and all of these things. So, yeah, I can understand that she's been overwhelmed for a while. Like, that makes total sense. But when she gets to Camp Half-Blood, she's going to have help. And I don't think she realizes that that was an option. Mm-hmm. She just sees that right here, right now, these people want to say, you have no more responsibility to anybody but us, and we're going to help you, and you will be a part of this group, and we, you know, like, she just feels this, like, sense of belonging that she hasn't had because she's been the person in charge of everything for so long.
Right.
And I feel so bad because I'm mad at her for just abandoning her brother, who she seemed to care about. Mm-hmm. But I'm also really frustrated with Zoe and Artemis especially for not trying to do what was best for her rather than just adding to their numbers.
Right. Yeah. And I think at least this decision needed time to stew, because right now she's just learning. She literally just learned about demigods and stuff like minutes ago. Mm-hmm. And she sees this group of girls who are powerful, who are awesome, who get to be immortal, who get to run around with a god. Like, obviously, like, I would want to do that too. But to not sit down and think it fully through just seems so irresponsible. And, yeah, I mean, I keep coming back to Nico, which is one of the other points that I wanted to make. This version of Nico is not the Nico that I'm most familiar with, because we think of Nico as this, like, brooding, sad boy, son of Hades. He's so hyperactive here. He's so full of questions. And, I mean, I love this version of him, but I feel like I'm not fully prepared for, like, I'm assuming, like, when Bianca dies, like, I'm not fully prepared for, like, the Nico that I remember to kind of come out of that, and it's going to be heartbreaking.
Yeah. No, I'm with you. I keep picturing him as this moody kid dressed in all black leaning against a tree. Yeah. Like, that's what, you know, with embers swirling around him, like,
just got, Ash, like, Derek Hale vibes.
Ash, but, yeah, I mean, for me, it's Damon. It's Damon Salvatore vibes, where he's just kind of looming in the background. And
sad brother vibes. Yeah. I mean, that's dark, pretty much
dark, sad brother vibes. Yeah,
dark, sad brother vibes.
And, I mean, that's my Nico aesthetic. So it's so hard seeing him here as this giddy kid who's excited about, you know, basically his Mythomagic game is coming to life before his very eyes, and it's like, what? Like, this is all real, and I'm gonna ride with Apollo? Like, let's do this. Yeah. Like, yeah. So, it's very sweet to see him here, but now I'm dreading seeing the path that takes him to the moody Nico.
Right.
We all know and love, but
you can, like, feel the anvil hanging over your head, just waiting for it to drop.
Yeah, it's true. It's absolutely true. Okay. I think that pretty much wraps up this chapter. It hits all the high points. There are a few other little tiny things, but I'm sure, you know, if they come important, we'll talk about them then. So let's move on to favorite quotes. Karen, do you want to do yours first?
Yeah, this is when Percy is basically talking about Nico and going, I figured any second he was going to ask me how many hit points I had. I just found this hilarious. And I want, like, a little Percy Jackson, like, trading card with, like, you know, what his value is and his rarity and, like, all that kind of stuff. That would be so cool.
My question is Riptide a separate card, or is Riptide a part of Percy's card?
I feel like Riptide would be a separate card, but, like, you could play them in pairs or something, you know? Like, they go together.
I was gonna say, is Percy's, like, attack gonna be, like, Riptide Strike or something?
Maybe.
Or is Riptide a separate entity, and Percy's attacks are more water-based and all that. That's where my brain went.
He's a water-based Pokemon.
He is. He's a water Pokemon, totally. Blastoise, go!
Oh, what Pokemon would he be? We don't have to answer this now. It just popped into my head, but
I mean, Squirtle.
Squirtle.
And he evolves.
That's true.
I have no idea. It'd have to be a water Pokemon, but yeah, I am not well-versed in all the water neither. Pokemon.
We should give... Maybe that'll be an episode. We give all the main Percy Jackson characters Pokemon. Pokesonas.
Oh,
Pokesonas.
Pokesonas.
If you guys are interested in that, let me know, because Lord. I'll do it, but only if you guys want it.
I would have to do a little research, yeah, but it would so be would fun. I. It would be fun.
Hilarious.
Oh, good times. Okay. My favorite quote is from Artemis about Nico, and she says, "Certainly not. He will go to camp. Unfortunately, that's the best boys can do." To which Percy goes, "Hey!"
Yeah.
And I just love the little, like, excuse you, us boys do very well. Thank you very much. We don't need you and your little hunters. Like, I just feel Percy's indignation.
Did he turn into a British aristocrat at the end there?
Apparently.
Little hunters.
You and your hunters. They're going to just go away. No, but, like...
with a pipe.
Precisely. No, it just, like, I feel so bad for Percy, because he's like, listen, Camp Apple, it's awesome. I didn't even know about your little group here until about 3 seconds ago, and y'all can just, you know, disappear. Anyway. But, yeah, good times, good times. Okay, so favorite moments. Karen, do you want to go ahead and do yours?
Nico lining up his little figurines and, like, Percy recognizing who they were. It was just so cute.
It is really cute. Poor innocent Nico.
I know. Yeah. It will all be ripped away soon.
Just treasure him while you can. Anyway. Mine was Percy trying to reason with Bianca before it's too late. Like, he was the sole person saying, you're jumping, you know, way ahead here. You don't need to do this yet. And she even says, like, maybe I should think about it. And Zoe keeps, you know, throwing barbs at her. So...
And I feel like Percy wasn't necessarily talking her out of joining the Hunters, just not yet. Not until you see camp and see what an alternative is.
And weigh what it's going to cost you with Nico and, like, is that really what you want? Like, do you really want to not have access to your brother on a regular basis? I mean, you'll probably still see him occasionally, but, you know, like, it's not, you're not going to be free to do whatever you want when you want it. And that's, you know, it's a lot to give up. It really is. Okay, so that finishes chapter 3, and we are on to chapter 4, Talia Torches New England. So Apollo shows up with his red Maserati Spider to give the youngins a safe ride to camp. He insists that Talia drive, so she does her best, reminding Percy of when his mother let him drive her car. Nico asks Apollo about the sun and the chariot and how all of that science and mythology works. Talia burns down a forest, freezes Cape Cod, and then lands the bus in the middle of the lake at Camp Half-Blood. But they make it there, so, you know. All right, so yeah, this chapter is a little less packed. I feel like that last one had quite a bit to it, since they spend most of the ride, or most of this chapter, in the bus.
It's literally just getting from point A to point B.
There's still some stuff going on, but a little less, so it's not quite as packed full. First of all, Apollo.
Oh my god, I was ready for Apollo. I'm so excited because I really love the Trials of Apollo books. I think Apollo's arc through those 5 novels was really, really well done. And he has such a strong voice. He's such a character. And I was so excited to see him again for the first time. It's cool to kind of see where he started within the Riordanverse. And, like, of course the ultra-feminist would have a condescending brother who mansplains and calls people sweetheart. Like, he's so infuriating, but because I know where he ends up, like, I love him so much.
He's such a bro.
He is.
Like, he's got the car of his dreams, and he's driving around.
Good looks. And...
Yeah, he's that shaggy blonde who, you know, loves to surf, and, you know, that's just Apollo to me. He is the ultimate bro. Until he learns.
And then it's so rewarding when he learns. That's why I like it, is the payoff is so good.
Yeah, but I do quite love Apollo here. He's a nice dose of humor after all of the Artemis stuff, which kind of sits heavy on you. Yeah. Like,
and Annabeth
and
just
Annabeth.
Being gone.
Absolutely, yes. Like, there's a lot of heavy that happened in that last chapter. So having Apollo show up and annoy Artemis to no end, which is hilarious because brothers and sisters, man, that's what they do. It's all good. It's all good fun. And then, him and just his air, how he is quite entertaining. So fun to see Apollo. We also got an explanation, a bit of an explanation of how the sun as we know it, as a scientific entity and, like, an astronomical entity, like, how we know the sun, and the mythology of Apollo being the person who drives the chariot across the sky and brings sunlight, you know, to your day and starts the day off, how those can kind of exist at the same time, it's a very interesting explanation.
It is, and so I really love this because Rick doesn't shy away from the hard questions. Like, he could just not have that in the book and it wouldn't feel like you were missing anything.
Mm-hmm.
But Rick's a teacher. Rick's had kids. He knows kids ask questions. And so he wanted to answer them. And I feel like it's not like a clear-cut answer. We don't get the whole truth of, like, how it exists. But just like when we visited the underworld and that preacher went up to, like, the gates or whatever, he saw hell when really he was in the underworld. And I think it's the same sort of thing where, like, Apollo pulls the sun across the sky and what... how the chariot exists is because humanity believes in the sun and believes that it has power and it affects them. But at the same time, like, yes, there is also this ball of gas out in the universe that exists. And, like, the fact that they can coexist, like you were saying,
yeah.
Very complicated, not an easy thing to wrap your head around. But, like, I'm okay with just letting it be messy.
I didn't choose it as my favorite quote, but his thing about, like, it's just because Artemis used to call me a fiery ball of gas is quite funny. As an explanation for why humans are taught what the sun is made of and you know, what it does. And I thought that was pretty funny. All right, moving right along. We get an idea of Talia's age. We kind of knew that she became a tree at age 12.
Right.
And we know that she was a tree for 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
So technically, if you were thinking about it, she's 19.
Right.
But she looks 12.
Right.
Which is really weird and hard to wrap your brain around as a, you know, 19-year-old, you know, looking in the mirror, like, you still look like you when you last saw you, but you're supposed to kind of be 19.
Mm-hmm.
So Talia is definitely going through a bit of a, like, I don't really know what I'm supposed to, like, am I supposed to be acting 12? Am I supposed to be acting like, you know, a 19-year-old?
Yeah. Because there's a pretty big difference between those two
ages. Absolutely. Like, you learn a lot in those years.
Yeah.
And Apollo kind of helps a bit to simplify matters. Like, he kind of feels her out.
Yeah.
And is like, you're 16.
Yeah.
Which is, it makes some sense. It's kind of a happy medium. It's, you know, finding a place in between. And Apollo doesn't really explain how he gets to that.
Yeah.
He just kind of says, this is part of what I do, and you're 16.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so basically she just aged more slowly while she was a tree, essentially. Which I think kind of makes sense because, I mean, we don't have to get into it, but, like, trees live a long time, you know, like, it would make sense if her morphology changes that something about her age would change as well. And she didn't have those experiences of being alive. So mentally, she's still 12 because I think she remembers very vague, like, feelings about being a tree, like restful and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But she doesn't have, it's not like she could see out through the tree and see what was going on and learn stuff. So yeah, like, I think she's turning 16, like, next week, Apollo said, or something. Yeah. So she's basically 16, and I know we've talked about ages and stuff on here before with Grover and how all of that fits in. So she's essentially, like, 2 years older than Percy, but has limited experiences due to being a tree. So they're kind of on the same page, I think, which is interesting because, in a way, I feel like Percy does look up to her, even though she's kind of a newcomer at this point.
Yeah. I mean, she's not new when it comes to fighting monsters. She did that for a very long time on her own. But
being in camp and
being a part of the team and, you know, really, like, Annabeth and Percy and Grover are a well-oiled machine at this point. Mm-hmm. They know each other's strengths and weaknesses. So Talia trying to find her sort of role in that is got to be tough because she, as much as, like, she did work with Luke and Annabeth, you know, back when. It's not the same thing, and she's been so apart from all of it. Yeah, I think you're right. That it's new for her. It's
interesting that she doesn't look up to Percy. Like, she has a very strong personality, and I think she's very, like, headstrong and a go-getter, so it makes sense But instead of having her look up to Percy as somebody who has more experience, who can kind of help her, she just, you know, takes charge. And I think that kind of throws him a little bit.
Oh, yeah. Child of Zeus.
Yeah.
I'm in charge. Yeah. The big surprise there. The end of this chapter with Talia and all of her driving antics, which is hilarious.
It was a lot. I said maybe all those fluctuating temperatures that we've had lately going from 70 to 20 is because Apollo was training another student driver.
You know, it's not just us. I have a friend who lives in like Georgia, and I believe I saw something about it being 80 degrees like last weekend, and now it's like 30 or 40 down there.
Oh,
like,
my gosh.
It's not just a Midwest thing. I think there's a lot of areas of the country that are fluctuating like crazy. But yeah, so we get her driving the short bus. I don't know. It was a small bus to fit all of them, all of the hunters plus Nico and Percy and Annabeth and Talia. So, and Grover. I was like, did I remember everybody? It's like Annabeth's gone, but Grover's there. So yeah, I might have messed that up. But yeah, so she crash lands into the lake. Or I assumed it was the sound, because isn't that the biggest body of water? Isn't it connected to the, I don't know.
I'm not.
He called it the lake in the book, okay. I'm pretty sure. Oh, haha.
So the lake.
Karen's map has saved the day. There is a lake that has a connecting body of water to the sound.
Yeah, so I guess they crash landed in the lake, which is smaller than the rest of the ocean. So at least she made it to the water.
Right, that helps. It's not a smooth landing, but nobody died, so we're going to give her a thumbs up, because Apollo should never have let her drive.
No.
But he's Apollo, so of course he did. And that pretty much wraps up the chapter. They're now at Camp Half-Blood, all of them.
Yeah.
And the last time the hunters were there, we got a lot of history in these two chapters about the last time the hunters were there. Yeah. It didn't end very well.
They kind of set fire to things.
Yeah, so
this will be interesting.
We'll see what goes down. Yeah, for sure. Okay, let's do favorite quotes first. I'll let Karen go first again.
It's Grover being obsessed with Artemis, and how, was it Talia, I think, who kind of called him out on, like, all satyrs are so obsessed with Artemis, and he just goes, but she's so into nature. And it was just like, of course that would be, like, his thing, is, like, he just wants a nature girl, you know?
Right, oh yeah.
So funny.
For sure. My quote comes from Apollo, and it was, you know, there were a couple of things I considered, but I went with, let's go see if we boiled anyone important, shall we? Like, the
so
minute
unconcerned.
His sun chariot hits the water, it boils. Like, I didn't even think about that, but I'm like, holy cow, yeah, that would
How
not be good.
How many fish did they kill?
Right? What else is in that pond? Naiads?
Yeah.
You know, like, other things. Yeah, like, what's in that lake? Yeah.
I think it said, like, the naiads were swimming away with their, like, half-woven baskets and stuff, but
really angry at Apollo and whoever was driving.
You can't imagine that not one fish died or something.
Oh, absolutely not, yeah. No,
although dinner? I mean, it's already cooked and boiled.
Well, I was going to say, they probably won't let it go to waste, right?
Yeah.
All right, and then we do our favorite moments. I'll go first. Percy, a novice driver, trying to give instructions to Talia.
Yeah.
Like, him just going, like, brake! No, stop! No, turn! Like, he's back there, like, trying his darndest. He's backseat driving, and it's really funny.
To be fair, she kind of deserves some backseat driving.
Absolutely.
So.
Well, and him trying to, like, give her pointers, and she's like, I've got this! Like, you don't have this.
Yeah.
You've never driven a car. At least Percy has gotten behind the wheel once or twice with his mom. Like, he has the bare bones idea of what it's like. But yeah, no, just really funny. And what was yours?
Mine was Apollo and his haikus. classic from the Trials of Apollo series. It was just so nice to see the origin. Completely ridiculous, but I love every second of it.
And I do love the reference to him previously being addicted to limericks.
Yes.
Because that's just, it's a natural progression, and it makes
so
me laugh
funny
that he's moved into haikus.
Yeah.
It's a good time.
That's when we eventually get to the Trials of Apollo series. I'm going to have so much fun talking about all the, like, song references and, you know, all the media references and fandom and stuff.
Oh, yeah.
It's going to be great.
All right. And that wraps up our chapters for this week. Next week, we will be reading chapters 5 and 6, so make sure you do that. Prophecy Radio is produced by Subjectify Media. Follow our website on Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, and Instagram at Subjectify Media, or visit us at SubjectifyMedia.com. We are home to 3 other podcasts, including Rewatchable, where we rewatch canceled and cult classic shows, Not About the Weather, which is a general interest show that sometimes features interviews with creators, and Not Another Teen Wolf podcast, which was recently revived thanks to the upcoming Teen Wolf movie. You can contact Prophecy Radio directly on Twitter at Prophecy Podcast or on Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr at Prophecy Radio Podcast. You can email us your long form thoughts at prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com. Find us on Spotify, Apple, or any of your favorite podcast platforms. Please consider leaving a review or a 5-star rating because it really helps others find us, and that is awesome. You can leave us questions, comments, ideas for content you might want to see, any of that in any of these places. We would love to hear from you, or any of the random questions we've asked in this episode. I feel like there were a couple of them. So, anything we talked about, please feel free to let us know your thoughts. That would be great. Next week, we will be doing a deep dive into Poseidon, plus maybe considering who we would like to see play Poseidon in this TV show of ours that's coming up here.
I think it's worth discussing at this point and trying to just figure out who might be a good fit.
I mean, they're not going to announce any cast until they get the trio nailed down, and we've already known from Becky that she will let us know.
Yes.
Becky will tell us when the trio is nailed down, and we'll get that announcement when we're supposed to. But there are a lot of other characters, including the gods, especially, you know, Poseidon and Zeus, the ones that are influential in Lightning Thief, that we'll probably have to see. So it's worth thinking about. So,
I'm excited about this one.
It'll be good fun. Okay, so this is Kristen.
And I'm Karen.
And we're Prophecy Radio, signing off. Over and out.